We were in our introductory study looking at the historical stuff that's involved in Daniel sitting in its period of time. There are a lot of things that are significant, I think, about the period itself. We pointed out last time that Jonah had gone to Nineveh about 760 BC, and the whole city repented. And yet, in 722, which was just 38 years later, they hauled Israel, the northern 10.5 tribes, off into captivity. So one generation passed in Nineveh, and all of a sudden they were warlike again and doing their dirty deeds. Well, from 722, when Assyria took the northern kingdom into captivity, it was 110 years to 612 when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Nineveh. They did such a good job of destroying it that for a good part of probably the 19th century, biblical scholarship, liberal biblical scholarship, probably just liberal scholarship since it wasn't biblical, but it was about Bible thing. They said Nineveh was a myth. It wasn't even such a city as Nineveh until the archaeologists started digging around. But all I mean by that is that Nineveh had been completely wiped off the face of the earth so that the soldiers that trampled on that ground 300 years later didn't even know there'd been a city there. And that's an exercise of the discipline or judgment of God. And that was 612. Well, Jehoiakim, the king, who's the king in Daniel chapter 1, became king 3 years later, 609. And then in his third year, it was 606, 605, that year is what the record of the book of Daniel starts with. Now, you understand that Daniel wrote this after it was all over. I mean, he may have been writing along, but he didn't write this whole book in 605. That's just the time when it started. He didn't write it until it was all done, and that was in 535. 536, somewhere along in there, 70 years later, when he was an old man and he was winding up the record. We were talking about that kind of historical reality, and then we also talked about the contemporary prophets of that time, because Jeremiah was a prophet to the people in the land, and Ezekiel was a prophet to the exiles in Babylon, and Habakkuk was a prophet just a year or two before Nebuchadnezzar came and hauled Daniel and his three buddies off. And of course, it's in Habakkuk 2:4 that you find the text that Paul roots his grace message in the New Testament in, Romans chapter 1. There's a righteousness that is revealed to be from God by faith, according as it's written, and he quotes Habakkuk 2:4. And then in Galatians he says, now that we're justified by grace and not by law, because it's written in Habakkuk that the just by faith shall live. And then it's quoted again by whoever wrote Hebrews. And those are the prophets, and we spent a bit of time on the Habakkuk one, because I believe that Habakkuk 2:4 was actually the foundation for chapter 3, this book of Daniel, where they stood up against the king's edict. The three friends of Daniel were cast in the fiery furnace, and the challenge that Nebuchadnezzar gave was, what God will deliver you out of my hand? And they said, our God will. But they said that because they had this promise that the just by faith shall live. And from Habakkuk, that's in light of the invasion by Nebuchadnezzar into the land of Judah. So that's where we were last time. Now, this evening, what I would like to do is pick up the third year, because it says in the opening of the statement, Daniel 1:1, it was in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And it says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. We're not going to get to verse 2 this evening particularly, because we're still talking about some of the historical background stuff. But if you were to read the records of 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, where Jehoiakim's rule in Judah is recorded, it tells us that he ruled in Jerusalem 11 years. But in the third year of his reign, he became completely subject to Nebuchadnezzar, because Nebuchadnezzar came in the third year and basically subdued him. I don't think there was any fighting that went on that in that particular scenario. Jehoiakim's father, Josiah, the good king. He was the one that they found the record in the temple of the law, and when he got through reading it, he said, "Oh man!" And so he called everybody, and there was a big revival in Judah. Well, he had gone out to fight against Pharaoh Necho from Egypt, and in 609, he was Jehoiakim's dad, and Pharaoh told him, he said, "Get out of here. You don't have any business here. The God, El, has sent me here, and if you don't get out of the way, he'll destroy you." Well, Josiah was a godly man, but he wasn't always, he didn't pay attention. So he clothed himself in some ordinary warrior clothes, and he ended up getting some arrows shot into him, and then afterwards he died. And one of his sons became king, but Pharaoh deposed him and put Jehoiakim, who was Eliakim to start with, but he changed his name to Jehoiakim. So that's the flux, that's the historical stuff that's going on. But the thing that we need to understand about this third year thing is that he wasn't deposed. He was simply put in subjection under Nebuchadnezzar's authority. And in fact, he rebelled. There 4 years later, Nebuchadnezzar had come back. Now, it was probably eight years later, he rebelled. And then Nebuchadnezzar came back and deposed him and put another fellow in his place. But all of that to say this, according to 2 Chronicles 36:21, the Babylonian captivity occurred because the Jewish nation had been put under a mandate to allow the land to rest from its labors in producing food for the nation every seventh year. They were supposed to not plant, not plow, not harvest. Every seventh year they were supposed to let the ground lie fallow. And naturally there would be stuff that grew up from the seeds from the year before that had fallen on the ground, that kind of thing. But they weren't supposed to work the land. And then every seven times seven, after the 49th year, the seventh of those Sabbath years, they had the year Jubilee, the 50th year, and that was a Sabbath year too. So on the 48th year, the harvest was supposed to be massive enough that it would carry the nation through the 49th year and the 50th year and into the 51st year until the harvest of that year, so they could replenish their food supply. And God had made this commitment and called them sabbatical years. And the reason is because, according to Exodus, when God established the Sabbath, which was the Saturday of every week, and then he established these sabbatical years at the seventh year of every seven-year period, he point-blankly said, "This is the sign of my covenant with you." And it was for that reason that they didn't tolerate the guy that went out on the Sabbath shortly thereafter to gather wood. Because right after God had said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I'm making with you," the Jews in the wilderness had a guy that went out on the Sabbath to gather some firewood, and they caught him and dragged him up to Moses and said, "What do we do with him?" And God said, "Kill him." Because he wasn't just picking up sticks, he was thumbing his nose at the covenant. And the covenant was the national constitution of the nation. So it was a big deal. And that's significant when you stop to think about what the New Testament says in regard to the observance of the Lord's table. Because in the observance of the Lord's table in 1 Corinthians 11, there are some people in Corinth who are going early, and they're eating all the food and drinking all the wine, getting drunk, and not leaving any for the people that are coming in later. And Paul says, for this reason, some of you are sick, and some of you are weak, and some of you sleep. And that's a euphemism for being dead. And the point is that that was the sign of the new covenant. This is the new covenant in my blood, Jesus said. And when you don't pay attention to the blood of the new covenant, then God responds with this fairly severe discipline. So that's a pattern of disciplinary thing. And according to 2 Chronicles 36, the reason that Judah was carried into captivity is because they had ignored the Sabbath years for 490 years. And that's not necessarily concurrent years. But they owed the land 70 years of rest. They had been ignoring this 7-year and 50th year mandate for several hundred years. And God wrote it down every time. And when he got to 70, you owe the land 70 years, he hauled them off. Gave the land its rest.
It will rest.
And you know, I thought the other day when I was thinking about that, is 70 times 7 is the 490, because you have the 7 years, and the 70 times 7 is ignoring the sabbaticals. But how many times did Jesus say you're supposed to forgive somebody? 70 times 7. And a lot of people say, well, that means indefinitely. Well, apparently it doesn't, because when they got to the 490, I mean, when they owed the land 70 years, God said, okay, you're gone. And he didn't take a lot of captives in this third year. But the third year, when you figured that God was writing down the record of you're not letting the land rest, you're not letting the land rest. Every 7 years, you didn't let the land rest. Every 50th year, you didn't let the land rest. He was keeping this record. Well, the third year may well have been, I don't know whether it was or not, but may well have been the last straw that they had ignored. The 70th rest that the land was owed had to have happened then during that period somewhere long in there, because if God had waited for Nebuchadnezzar to go in there another 7 years, then they'd owed him 71. So that's part of what this whole thing is about, is that the timing is right on target. And we're going to see when we get to Daniel 9 just how precise the timing things are, because there are specific designations of how much time is going to happen, how much time is going to go by, and what's going to happen, and all that kind of thing. And of course, that's part of the whole biblical pattern of God insisting that we believe him when he says something. I was reading the last day or two, the record of God coming to Abraham when he's 99 years old, and he says, I'm going to return at this time next year, and your wife's going to have a son. And Sarah laughs, and she's listening through the tent wall, and she laughs. I'm 89 years old. I'm going to be 90 before this promised baby comes. He said, it ain't happening. And that's that text where that statement that is always quoted, is there anything too hard for Yahweh, for the Lord? That's the context of that question. Because she frankly didn't believe it was going to happen until God confronted her. And it was that confrontation, I think, that actually worked into her development of a faith that then allowed her to conceive. Because Hebrews 11 says, by faith Sarah conceived seed. So she had to have come to faith instead of laughter. It's interesting that she named her son Laughter, Isaac. But the point of all that is that these words in this book, Daniel, they're all significant words. Every jot and tittle comes to pass, that kind of thing. And we read over them and go on, and that's normal for us. But nonetheless, I really think that this third year thing is because of the Sabbath legacy. Because God basically said, you guys have ignored me and brushed off my Sabbath sign of the covenant with you for 490 years, and I've had it. You're going to give the land the 70 years rest that it needs. And so that's what happened. They were hauled off into captivity. And later in the book of Daniel, it says that when the 70 years were almost complete, Daniel had gotten the writings of Jeremiah. And he had read in there that God had prophesied a 70-year period, and then they'd be able to return to the land. And when that 70-year period came close to being fulfilled, that's the foundation for Daniel's long prayer in Daniel 9, prayer of repentance. Oh, Lord, hear. Oh, Lord, forgive. We've been rebellious. And I mean, it was a prayer of repentance for the nation, but it was in preparation for being restored to the land. So all of these things are at work when we start into our study of Daniel and the prophecies and the history and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that I wanted us to think about on the second page there and see the problem of faithful believers living in apostate conditions, because there were promises made in the covenant that if you walk in harmony with the revelation of what God wanted from you, and Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Ezra did, they were doing that. Well, there were promises made to them, promises of prosperity and health and all that kind of stuff. And yet, because the nation as a whole had gone into deep apostasy, Daniel and his three friends were shipped off into captivity to Babylon. There's an implication that they were castrated by the king and turned over to the head of the eunuchs. They suffered some significant issues. And then, you know, they got thrown in the fire furnace, the lion's den, all that. How do you deal with that as a believer in the promises of the covenant? Not my fault. Daniel could have said, what am I doing here? Not my fault. I was walking with God and doing what he wanted me to do, and he made these promises. And actually, we run into the same thing in Luke's record with Elizabeth and Zacharias. Because it says that Elizabeth was a daughter of the priesthood. Zacharias was the son of a priest. They both came from the tribe of Levi. And they were both righteous before God. But she was barren. And in the covenant, it had said, if you walk in my law, your wives will not be barren. So there's this tension of how you're supposed to live when God has made certain commitments, but they don't seem to fly. When you depend on them, they don't seem to develop the way you expected them to. And I can hear the underlying disappointment in Zacharias and Elizabeth saying, we've been trying to walk with God, we've been trying to be faithful to the covenant, and we don't have a son, we don't have a child. My wife's barren. Elizabeth says, I'm barren, I can't produce a child for my husband. What am I doing wrong? Because that's the natural response that we give when things don't go the way we expect. Well, I thought God made a commitment and it's not happening, so it must be my fault. Because he wouldn't. It's not his fault. And technically, the promise was fulfilled. Zacharias and Elizabeth had a son, and therefore she was not barren, and therefore the promise was kept. But it was miraculously done. That's true, Billy, but one of the problems that we run into is, well, what are we supposed to believe? I mean, I thought walking by faith meant understanding what God had promised and expecting it to be fulfilled. Isn't that what it is? And the answer is, yes, that's what it is. But there are certain circumstances that you have to deal with when God makes a promise to a nation, and individuals within the nation are faithful, but the majority of the nation's not. The believers catch it in the neck just like the unbelievers do when the judgment hammer falls, except Habakkuk had been told by God, those that are just by faith will live. They're not going to be put to death by the Babylonians when they invade. So that was the current prophetic promise that they were supposed to zero in on. It may not mean that I'll have a, you know, fruitful family, fruitful wife with children. It may not mean that my particular geography will produce a lot of crops for me to eat well and all that. It may mean that the life the land is supposed to give me is going to be provided by God in a different way. And that's exactly what happened with Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah.
We miss the whole corporate aspect of it.
Yes, we do.
Thinking in our Western, thinking on an individual basis and not.
That's true.
What's happening with the whole.
But in the corporate thing, we cannot dismiss the individual application.
Right.
And so I still have, you know, the promise that he promised us is eternal life. So I'm supposed to believe that promise for me. And if the whole world goes to hell because they won't believe it, that doesn't mean I'm not going to get the promise because I'm trusting him to fulfill it. But in Israel's situation, the law was a national constitution made with the nation, and God made special provision for his people when the nation as a whole went off the rails.
But we have a tendency to want to believe in the here and now for all of those kind of promises for us individually, which the here and now, it may not be the here and now.
Well, especially when you move out of the covenant of law.
That's right.
Because the law was fixated on the here and now, and the outer man, and the historical setting.
Yeah.
And that's why it was a temporary covenant. Lasted about 1,500 years, and then it was set aside because Jesus came, fulfilled it all, and then moved into a whole different mode of operation. So that's one of the things that Habakkuk is the contribution in the setting. Just because just a year or year and a half before Nebuchadnezzar came, Habakkuk wrote Habakkuk, and he warned the people in Judah that God was going to discipline the nation with the Babylonians. But the promise, if you read Habakkuk, when God tells Habakkuk he's going to send the Babylonians, this scares Habakkuk to death. He said he is trembling, his bones are shaking. But when he got to the statement, the just by faith shall live, that became the promise that Habakkuk glommed onto. And at the end of the book, he said, I heard and I trembled, and then I rejoiced, and you know, I rejoiced in the God of my deliverance, and the whole tenor of his attitude shifted when he got that promise from God. And that was that promise that Daniel and those were counting on when they were in the Babylonian setting. They were going to survive, and not. And it, of course, they did survive quite well. And that's the foundation for all of chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, where the Gentiles are in control and they're very arrogant, and the Jews are under their thumb, but the Jews say, we're not going to worship your God, and you can throw us in a fire furnace if you want to, and it's going to be our God will deliver us. Daniel says, I'm not going to quit praying just because you made this stupid rule. He didn't say it that way. Daniel is a whole lot more, he was a lot wiser than I am. He didn't react with antagonism, but he said, I'm not going to quit praying just because the king made this rule. And so he went and prayed, and they threw him in the lion's den. Well, the king had a worse time of it than Daniel did, because the king couldn't sleep all night, and Daniel was down there probably sleeping. But in the morning early, the king was up and said, oh, Daniel, was your God able to deliver you? Yeah, get the rock off of this hole and let me out of here.
Daniel says, live forever, O king.
Yeah. I mean, and the king was actually a victim of his own foolishness, because he wasn't a Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar. He liked Daniel, and he got caught by his own everybody will be asking me, you know, he got to be the center of attention. That's a big trap.
That's funny. Interesting, though, that after the three came out of the fire, there's no mention of
it. Well, and I find it also interesting that Daniel's mentioned in that particular story. Where was Daniel? So it's all selective.
You didn't mention it either.
No, I wouldn't think so.
I wouldn't think so.
But, well, this past weekend, my son came home from France just for the week for some work he had to do in Austin, and he came to our Bible study, and he said, "I got a question for you, Dad. There's a record in the Gospels about these two crazy men who met Jesus in the land of the Gerasenes. They were demon-possessed and all that." But he said, "One of the records just says there's one man there." And I said, "Well, that's just selective record of the facts." I said, "If you read the words that were printed on the sign that hung on the cross, none of the four gospel writers record all the words that were written there. You have to take all four of them and put it all together." But that's what you do when you're recording theological narrative. You're trying to build a particular picture of Jesus, and there are certain facts that will fit that picture and enhance it so that you record those, and the facts that don't enhance it or don't move people, you just ignore them. Nobody, no historian records everything that happens. None of them. You couldn't. You couldn't even, if you had started writing this morning and you started writing everything that happened to you and to your neighbors and to your family and to your country and to your world, you would have a pile of books by the evening. I mean, you couldn't write it all. No historian ever records everything. People think, "Well, there's an error in the Bible." It's a selective omission on purpose, because it doesn't advance the narrative in the direction of the theology that the narrative is supposed to be developing. We find that, for example, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All three of those gospel writers referred to the temptation of Jesus. But Matthew and Luke wrote long paragraph. Mark wrote two verses. And yet in Mark's record of two verses, he tells us a couple of things that the others don't tell us in the long paragraphs.
And it's no different in the resurrection of Christ.
Sure.
You know how many were at the tomb, one thing, this book has this, this book has mm-hmm. this. So it's how God dealt with that individual to write.
Right. And even, for example, the story in the what they call the synoptics. There's no such thing as synoptics, but that's what they call them. So I'll just use the term. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell us that Jesus had ate the Passover with his disciples and went out and to the Garden of Gethsemane and was arrested, and then he was taken to the high priest, and then he was taken to Pilate early the next morning. But John tells us that he was crucified at the time of the hour when the lambs were being slain for the Passover. So here you have three of them telling him he ate the Passover the day before, and then you have John come along and saying he was killed when the Passover lambs were being killed, and everybody freaks out. Wah, wah, wah. And none of them tell you how that can be, but in the historical backdrop of that, if you do some study about the historical stuff, you'll find out that the Galileans observed the Passover a day earlier than the Judeans did. That's the answer. But the Bible doesn't tell us that's the answer. It just tells us the stuff that is building the story. And John started his gospel out with, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." And when he dies when the lambs are being slain. It's part of his story.
Wasn't it John that says there's more stuff happening than
you can write about? Oh, yeah. He said the world couldn't contain the books. So, yeah, it's just selective history. But that's what you run into. Even here in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the captivity thing, all of that presupposes that you've read 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings. So you understand that God's sending Judah off into captivity because of discipline for the 70 Sabbath that they ignored. It's not a good thing to ignore the covenants.
and then the naysayers will take these little incidents to prove that there are errors in the Bible.
Oh, sure, they try.
The numbers of the armies and whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some scribal errors in you know, listing from 4,000, like the horses of Solomon, 40,000 or 4,000. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but they'll take those little tidbits and they'll say, see, the Bible is wrong.
Yeah.
It's an error.
Yeah. Any way to try to get out of having an authoritative word from God.
the thing is, I really believe this. I mean, if all of us broke down what took place here tonight, I mean, it just proved to me the more authenticity of what took place, because all of us are going to see it in a different way.
Absolutely.
And the Gospels are all written, like you say, in a different way, different audiences and stuff, so... To me, what we call errors just proved to me that it's inspired by God, because each one of them wrote what he thought, what he did.
Yeah.
Well, I'd only be the one inspired by God. So
But even in law enforcement, when you take your case to trial, you got this witness that says it happened like this, and you have this witness that says it happened like this, and both of them are telling the truth. But one of them was standing on that corner, and the other was standing on this corner. So what they saw was somewhat different. What they saw was valid, it's just that...
Well, they claim the best way to commit a crime is in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
That way you got all that.
Okay. So, that's the historical setting. What we have in Daniel chapter 1 in the third year of King Jehoiakim is a definitive and critical historical setting, where Nineveh has been destroyed just 6 years before. Jehoiakim has become king just 3 years before. And they're being besieged by Nebuchadnezzar before another Sabbath goes by. or they'll owe the land 71 Sabbaths. And then, you know. But nonetheless, those are the kinds of things that are going on. Now, I don't know if we can cover Romans 2 on the second page or not, the literary backdrop. But I do want to point out some things here, and then we'll get into the details probably starting next week. But if you were to read Daniel in the languages that he wrote it in, you would read chapter 1 and then in chapter 2, all the way down through verse 3, you would have been reading Hebrew. It was written in Hebrew. But in verse 4 of chapter 2, it says, now the king, the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. And from verse 4 of chapter 2 all the way through chapter 7, Daniel wrote in Aramaic. And then starting in chapter 8, verse 1, he switched back to Hebrew. Now there's got to be a reason for that. This is what we call the literary design of a book, or the literary design of the author's way of presenting it. Literary design simply means that there's a certain approach that the author is taking in terms of literary structure. For example, when you read a poem, you recognize that it's a poem because of the literary design. These two lines rhyme, and then these two lines rhyme, and so on, because that's the literary techniques. Well, when a guy sits down and starts writing the record of a book, and he writes the introductory chapter in one language, and then he switches over to another language, and the language he switches over to actually records all the details that have to do primarily with the Gentiles, and then he switches back into the original language in chapter 8, and all that has to do primarily with the way the history is going to affect the Jews. So, you say, oh, okay. He wrote the book for popular consumption, but there were a whole bunch of Gentiles in Babylon who, if they read it, would have to skip chapters 1 and 8 through 12 because they couldn't read it, because they were Aramaic speakers and not Hebrew speakers. So he had a message for the Gentiles, and that message is in chapters 2 through 7. But he had a message for the Jews, and that message was in chapter 1 and chapters 8 through 12. That's just a part of the way the language breaks it down. And then we have another issue in regard to chapters 2 through 7, another issue of literary design. The first time I was working my way through Daniel, I stumbled across this. I didn't know it, and I didn't even know what to call it. But it says there in Romans 2b, the chapters written for the Babylonians, the Chaldean chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, they're set up, and the word is chiastically. Well, that's a literary technique. And the technique is like this. You say something, and you follow it with something else, and you follow it with something else, and then you repeat this in another way here, and then you repeat that down here, and then you repeat that down here. So it's A, B, C, C prime, B, A. That's a chiasm. And the point of a chiasm is the center ones. In other words, A and B, they're important, but they're not the point. The point is C and C and B and A. C and C, this is the point. Well, interestingly, when you look at the chapters 2 and 7, both deal in vision and interpretation of vision with the development of history through consecutive empires. In chapter 2, you have this vision that the king has, and the interpretation of the vision is that you're going to be this one, and then after you is going to rise another kingdom, and then another kingdom, and then another kingdom. Okay? In chapter 2, that's the image of the 90-foot-tall image. Chapter 7 has wild beasts. There's going to be this lion, and then there's going to be this bear raised up on three legs. And then there's going to be this winged leopard. And then there's going to be this indescribable monster beast. But when the interpretation's given, it's you're the lion, Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon. And the bear is the kingdom that comes up after you. And the leopard is the kingdom that comes up after you. And the indescribable beast is the kingdom that comes after that. So we're still dealing with the development of empires in world history. We're given it to us in different images, but in the interpretations of the images, the interpretation comes out basically the same way. It's just that there's a different focus on how we're supposed to think of these empires. In chapters 3 and 6, chapter 3 is the fiery furnace, and chapter 6 is the lion's den. And they both deal with God's deliverance of these faithful Hebrews who are accused by their Chaldean competitor counterparts to the king in hopes that the king will be willing to destroy them so that these guys that want their jobs will get them. Those three guys that you appointed, they're not bound down to your image like you said. What do these accusers want to happen? They want the king to throw them in the fire furnace and then we'll get their jobs. Why did they come up with a conspiracy against Daniel in Daniel 6? Make a law, O king, that nobody for 30 days, nobody can ask anything of anyone except you. Can you imagine how dumb that law was? Here you got this little 3-year-old toddler saying, Mama, can I have a bottle of milk? Throw him in the lion's den. He didn't ask the king. He asked Mama. I mean, it was a dumb law, but Darius was seduced in the idea of being so important. But the point there is that they were both, that attempt against Daniel was an attempt to get rid of him because he was going to be exalted over the other two. The king had set the kingdom up under three, and Daniel was the one that was at the top of the three, and they wanted him out of there so they could be there. So it was just a way to try to get rid of him, just like the Pharisees did to Jesus. Kill him, then we'll have our following back. And then in chapters 4 and 5, These are both chapters about God's confrontation of arrogant Chaldean kings as they reject God's right to sovereignty over them. Nebuchadnezzar says, "Is this not great Babylon that I have built with my might?" And a voice comes in and says, "It's going to be taken away from you," you know, and he turns into, thinks he's a donkey or something. And for 7 years, he's out there eating the grass and growing long hair and real thick fingernails. And then he comes to himself and he praises the God of heaven. And then immediately the next chapter is the record of the last king of Babylon, Belshazzar. And Daniel comes out of retirement because the king summons him to interpret this handwriting on the wall. And Daniel just lays into him. He said, "Oh, you knew all this stuff that Nebuchadnezzar went through, and in spite of that, you act like an arrogant. And so I'll interpret it for you. You're dead tonight." And that night, he was killed. But the point is, these sets of chapters, 2 and 7, 3 and 6, 4 and 5, they're just reproductions of each other. 2 and 7, 3 and 4, or 3 and 6, and 4 and 5. But a chiasm says chapters 4 and 5 are the key. Well, what is the key? It's God confronting the arrogant, and he confronts the one's arrogance and results in salvation, and the other's arrogance he confronts with death, because the one didn't learn the lesson. Well, what's the point there? I believe it's James's point. God resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar are the arrogant, and the three Hebrew young men going in the lion's den or the fire furnace, and Daniel going, they're the humble. God resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. I really believe that that's the message to the Gentiles in Daniel. Daniel is a book about prophecy, but the message is very practical. If you exalt yourself, God's going to humble you. He resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. Or God will stick them back in. Right.
And in Ephesians, Paul even kind of maybe a semi-reference to that when he tells him in chapter 2, somewhere around verse 11 or so, he says, "And you remember you Gentiles at one time
were without God."
All this stuff that the Jews had. It's almost like it's a little bit of an echo of what he said in Romans. You know, remember what you were.
Right.
They thought it humbled you and produced a grateful heart instead of
an arrogant heart. And that's the key in terms of literary design. The book is divided into two languages. It's got two messages, one for the Gentiles, one for the Jews. The message to the Gentiles is if you act arrogantly, you got God to face. He's going to deal with your arrogance. But on the other hand, if you humble yourself like these Jewish men did, then God will look out for you. He'll give grace to the humble. That's the message, the big message. The Gentiles and the Jews both get a big message from the chiasm.
And even in that, you had the comparison between Nebuchadnezzar, who came to his senses and acknowledged God, and Belshazzar, who was so arrogant that he died.
Yeah. And in fact, when you read in Daniel 1 that God gave them over into his hand, it says, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And what was Belshazzar's downfall? He brought those vessels out and started drinking wine to his gods. And that's when that handwriting started on the wall. And that hand was just scrabbling on, "Meeny, meeny, tickle, you farson." What's that mean? It means you're dead, king, tonight. For your arrogance. Right. So, yeah. And there are a lot of things like that. We'll see them as we go into details. But also, there's one more thing. And we got just a few minutes. I want you to notice the way that the chapters are set up thematically. Because in the introduction, we're in the third year of Jehoiakim. And then in chapter 2, you're in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is a different time frame, but it's obviously chronologically subsequent to chapter 1. And then it says in chapter 5 that Belshazzar the king had this great feast and he died that night. So that was the last year of his reign. But then when you go over to chapter 7, it says in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream. So now he's backing up. Chapter 5, where Belshazzar dies, is the last year of his rule. But in chapter 7, which is literally subsequent to chapter 5, it's actually the first year of Belshazzar. So he's telling us, look, I'm not writing this chronologically. Well, what does that mean? It means I'm writing it thematically. There's a theme here I want you to pick up on. And then if you go over to chapter 8, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So chapter 8 is before chapter 5, but it's after chapter 7. In terms of what he's writing. And then in chapter 9, it's in the first year of Darius. And then in chapter 10, it's the third year of Cyrus. So what I'm trying to say here is that the chapters are written thematically for the Hebrews, for the Jews. It was chiastically for the Gentiles, thematically for the Jews. But the whole issue here is Daniel had a message. It's in large part from the setting, it's prophetic. But the prophecy is simply a tool to address some very practical truths. And it's interesting that in the prophetic scheme, there is at the end of the whole prophetic thing, this enormously arrogant Gentile king who rises up against God. And then he is smashed, it says, without a hand, by the stone that's cut out of the mountain as it rolls across the plain and hits the image. So you still have this, you better humble yourself before this God, because he resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. So that's where we're going to be going as we look at the details in the chapters. I wanted to get the background and this kind of stuff in place so that when we were studying it, we could build off of our understanding of what's going on here historically and literarily. Because proper interpretation, there are four things that are crucial to proper interpretation. One of them is a theological design, which means why is this book in the revelation that God has given theologically? And then there's a literary design. What form of writing is this taking and how are we supposed to understand that form? That's why I said the chiasm is interesting, because it actually tells us what the key issue is. And then there's the question of what we call the subject. What's he talking about in the bigger scheme of things? What's he really talking about? And then, fourthly, what's he saying about what he's talking about? And those four things all have to be answered in order to properly understand what God is saying. You have a theological thing, and that's why you can't have Scripture contradicting itself theologically, because God's in this. This is God's Word. And then you have the literary thing, where we recognize the Psalms are written in different kind of form and structure and language than historical narrative, for example. And the epistles of the New Testament are not historical narrative, but the Gospels and Acts are. And then you run into problems all the time when people read a verse and they don't know what the subject is. They don't know what he's talking about. And so they read the words and they give some kind of interpretation based on what they think is going on there. And they don't even know what he's talking about. And then they don't know what he's saying about what he's talking about, because they don't know what he's talking about. So when we're studying Daniel here, we're going to be working with these issues and trying to come to grips with what he's actually saying and what he means by it and what the significance of it is.